Chapter 36 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legimus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 36. As soon as I had sold the academy, which I did, with George Wyndham's assistance, only when I had got into the position of being utterly unable to find any more money to go on with it, I became, although I did not then know it, a mark, and ultimately an easy prey for my enemies. George Wyndham not only sold the paper for me, but while the negotiations for the sale were going on, he gave me £200 to carry on with. The negotiations, however, took several weeks, and if I had not had the luck to go to Ascot and back 11 winners in the 4 days' meeting, one of them being Winky Pop at 14-1, I could not have held out. As it was, when I collected the £2,000 for the sale of the paper, there was an overdraft at Cox's Bank, Guard's office, my bankers and the Academy's, separate accounts, though I controlled both, of £800. By the time I had given Crossland £250 and paid up the printers and all other outstanding creditors, there was not much left of the £2,000. As long as I had my paper, my enemies gave me a wide berth, especially after we had won the Manners Sutton case at the Old Bailey. During the whole time I had the Academy, more than 3 years, I never had an action for libel brought against me. The reason for this was that, although we continually criticised and attacked with the utmost frankness and outspokenness, and always made a point of going for big people and disregarding the small fry, we were always sure of our ground. Instead of bringing actions for libel against us, the persons attacked frequently salved their wounded feelings by libelling me. The libels always took the same form, insinuations or insults on the subject of Oscar Wilde. When this happened, I issued writs at once, and in every case the libellers climbed down, apologised abjectly, and paid up. The sums I got for compensation from persons who libelled me, and squealed for mercy when I writted them, were for a long time, in a small way, quite a source of income to me. Among the sums paid as compensation, and in consideration of the discontinuance of legal proceedings, were 50 guineas from the Isis, the Oxford undergraduate magazine, and 50 guineas from the Cambridge magazine, paid by the dons who ran the paper. In both cases, the undergraduate editors were dismissed, and their dismissal was taken into consideration in mitigation of damages. I could, of course, have extracted much larger sums than those I actually accepted, but my idea was to be generously contemptuous of this sort of petty spitefulness. I took 50 guineas and the dismissal of the editors just to teach them a gentle lesson. I have been trying to add up all the actions for libel which I have had to take in my life, and really I find that I have lost count. On the spur of the moment I can think of at least 8. I lost only one of them, my action against Ransom, already referred to. By far the greater number of them were settled out of court by payments and apologies to me. As I write now, I have a crop of actions, or at any rate, so far, threatened actions, in respect of booksellers who will persist in selling in a hole-and-corner way Harris's book, The Life and Confessions of Oscar Wilde, knowing full well that it contains gross libels on me. Footnote. Since this was written, I have obtained damages in respect of 3 libel actions, only one of which got into court. In each case, the defendants were booksellers who sold copies of Harris's book. End footnote. It is exactly what one would expect, and quite characteristic of the sort of way history is written, or gets accepted, that I am regarded and described by many people as a man who is always libelling people. I have been twice convicted for libel at the Old Bailey, once for libelling my father-in-law, Colonel Custance, by accusing him of defrauding his daughter, and once for libelling Winston Churchill, by accusing him of writing a deliberately false account of the Battle of Jutland with the object of enabling a group of Jews to make a financial coup on the American stock markets. With regard to the first libel, I will only say that I subsequently repeated it quite as strongly and at much greater length, and supported it by chapter and verse in a 20-page postscript attached to a poem called Eve and the Serpent, of which I printed and circulated about 1,000 copies. The poem without the postscript appears in my Collected Satires, published by the Fortune Press. No proceedings were taken against me, though my late father-in-law consulted the late Sir George Lewis about the advisability of such proceedings. Sir George Lewis advised him that he had better not take any proceedings against me, and this advice was certainly not given out of any consideration for me, for Sir George and Colonel Custance were both, up to the day of their deaths, my most implacable enemies. I will further point out that when I won my action for libel and was awarded £1,000 damages against the Evening News for stating that I was violently eccentric and had shown marked signs of degeneracy, the solicitors for the Evening News were once more Lewis and Lewis, who had all the documents and all the information about my libel on Colonel Custance in their possession. My attack on Colonel Custance was brought up by them as part, indeed the principal part, of the Evening News's justification for their libel on me. The whole thing was thrashed out exhaustively in court. I was cross-examined on it for at least 2 out of the 6 hours during which I remained in the witness box, my cross-examiner being the, of course, deadly Sir Douglas Hogg, the Attorney-General, now Lord Hailsham. The result was that I certainly convinced the judge, Mr. Justice Horridge, and the jury, that I was entirely justified in what I had done in the case of Colonel Custance. The judge, in his summing up, of which I have shorthand notes, even directed the jury very strongly on the point. He said, "You have heard the plaintiff's account of the whole matter. If what he says is true, and no attempt has been made by the defendants to dispute it, you are certainly not likely to come to the conclusion that he was violently eccentric because of the attitude he took up about the way he was treated in regard to his son and his wife." It is, in short, perfectly obvious that if I had not been entirely justified in my attack on Colonel Custance, even admitting, as I do, that the form my attack took was unfortunate and injudicious, and made things very awkward for my wife by putting her into the dilemma of having to choose between supporting her husband or her father, I would, in the first place, have been prosecuted by Colonel Custance a second time, when I repeated the libel in much greater detail, and certainly sent to prison. On the first occasion I was merely bound over. And in the second place, I would have had no earthly chance of winning my action against the Evening News. That I lost the case when Custance prosecuted me at the Old Bailey in 1913 is solely due to the fact that, distressed and disheartened as I was by the defection of my wife and the loss of the ransom action a few days before, I threw up the sponge, did not put in a plea of justification or go into the witness box, and thus practically allowed the case to go against me by default. With regard to the occasion in 1923, when I was convicted and sentenced to 6 months' imprisonment for libelling Mr. Winston Churchill, I have not the slightest intention of saying anything which might be regarded as a repetition of the libel. But what I can and will say is, and I will make Mr. Justice Avery and all others concerned a present of the usual retort which is always employed on such occasions, I mean the retort about disappointed litigants, that my trial was a farce. I do not for a moment say that if my trial had been differently conducted, I would have established the truth of my libel, but I do say that if I had been allowed to explain to the jury how I came to print it, 3 years before my trial, in my paper Plain English, I would have convinced them, and any reasonable being, that I acted in perfect good faith, without the slightest malice, and in what I considered to be the public interest. As I had pleaded justification, that would not have won me the case, but it would at least have made it practically impossible for the judge to send me to prison. The vindication of Mr. Churchill from the charges I had brought against him would have been at least as complete if nearly all my counsel's questions to me had not been overruled by the judge, or again if Sir Douglas Hogg had given me a chance to explain myself in cross-examination. As it was, Sir Douglas Hogg asked me 2 questions and then sat down. This was very smart of him, and it was also the greatest compliment to my powers as a witness that has ever been paid to me. It was an admission that he did not care to give me the chance of giving the jury my version of the facts. It was very unfortunate for me that Sir Douglas Hogg, the Attorney General, happened to be the very counsel who had cross-examined me 2 years before for 6 hours on behalf of the Evening News, when I won my action against that journal. Sir Douglas knew what a formidable witness I was. He had seen me win a case for myself out of the witness box against tremendous odds, and he had seen that I had done it simply by getting the jury, as I always have done when I have had fair play in a court of law. Consequently, the next time he was opposed to me, he took the very unusual course of not cross-examining me. It was a great moral triumph for me, especially as my counsel, Mr. Cecil Hayes, with my consent, went out of his way to put in my character. This was a direct challenge to Hogg to say a word, if he dared, against my character, moral or otherwise. It was so pointed that the judge, Mr. Justice Avery, with an appearance of fairness to me which did not, I must say, impress me very much, interrupted Mr. Hayes and said meaningly, "Are you putting in the defendant's character, Mr. Hayes?" Mr. Hayes replied without hesitation, "Certainly I am, my lord. Let my learned friend ask him any questions he likes relating to his moral character." In face of that, Sir Douglas Hogg's failure to cross-examine me was, as I say, a great moral triumph for me, but unfortunately, like most moral triumphs, it was in the nature of a Pyrrhic victory. For the result was that I got no chance at all of using my brains and my gifts of speech and personality in my own defence. It really does not matter a pin now. My imprisonment nearly killed me, as I shall explain later on in this book, but from a social point of view, it has proved to be the turning point of my life. I have made more friends and converted more enemies by going to prison as I did, and in the cause which I represented, the cause of fearless criticism of public men, however powerful, than I had ever hoped to make again in this world. From that point of view, Mr. Churchill, who doubtless goes in for being a magnanimous man when he is not actually engaged in getting his critics sent to jail, will be pleased to hear that indirectly he has done me one of the best turns that it will be possible for one man to do for another. While I am about it, I think I ought to put it on record that Sir Douglas Hogg's cross-examination of me in the Evening News case, when I won, was conducted with the utmost politeness and good breeding, although, acting on the instructions contained in the brief prepared for him by Lewis and Lewis, he put all my stolen letters to Wilde to me, and dragged up again the whole question of my relations with Wilde, and my quarrel with my father. I can thus say that both methods, the brutal and the suave, were employed against me, the first by, among others, the then Mr. Marshall Hall, and the second by Sir Douglas Hogg, and that both equally failed. I think perhaps, all the same, that it is fairer to say that the failure in Sir Douglas Hogg's case was certainly less conspicuous than in the case of Marshall Hall, because I really knocked out Marshall Hall in about 40 minutes, while Sir Douglas Hogg lasted a full number of rounds, through a whole day and a half. There was no knockout, I won on points. With regard to the ransom case, which I lost, I have, of course, to admit that to the extent Sir James Campbell, who cross-examined me, got the better of me, but I do not consider that his victory was due to any deadliness on his part. He had overwhelming ammunition in the shape of my stolen letters sprung on me for the first time, and I, for reasons which I have already suggested, and which I would like to amplify, but cannot without making serious allegations against someone else, was fighting with one hand, metaphorically speaking, tied behind my back. Just as I ultimately completely turned the tables on Colonel Custance by my publication of my postscript to Even the Serpent, and also by my answers in cross-examination and victory in the Evening News case, so I completely turned the tables, I will not say on Mr. Ransom, because I have already explained that I do not regard him as more than a figurehead or stalking horse for Ross in the action, which he defended against me, but on Robert Ross, when I justified all my terrible charges against him at the Old Bailey in 1914. to sum it all up, and to get back to what I was saying before I got off into details of my various cases, it is not true that I am a man who is always libelling people. What is true is that I am a man who is always being libelled. I have dealt with the only two cases in which I was accused of libelling a man, that of Colonel Custance and that of Mr. Winston Churchill, and I have shown that one of those cases must go by the board, considered as anything against me in that respect. That leaves one case in which I have been proved legally to have libelled a man, and that one case certainly does not give anyone the right to say that I am a confirmed libeller, or that I delight in libel for libel's sake. Even my worst enemy must admit that I had nothing to gain by libelling Winston Churchill. It has never been suggested that I had the slightest ill feeling against him, nor, as a matter of fact, did I ever have any such feeling against him, nor have I any such feeling even now. All I did was to write about him what I believed to be true, at great risk to myself, because I thought it was my duty to my country to do so. For doing that, I was sent to prison, where I was nearly starved to death, and from which I emerged broken in health. It has taken me 3 years to get over the effects of my imprisonment, and even so I can say that I have never been, and am very unlikely ever again to be, as well and strong as I was before it took place. On the other hand, and to the credit side of the account, it is to be remembered that I wrote what I consider to be my finest poem, In Excelsis, in the prison hospital. So find we profit by losing of our prayers, and also by losing of our lawsuits. Sometimes. End of chapter 36.